I've got it incorporated from last week's year.
And in case you were wondering, it was provocative and it drew no small amount of reactions from Chutz La'aretz, which I had never realized that, you know, in our little Dalet Amot of our shir, things can go viral. And people needed some explanations. You know, here we are sitting in the building of the OU, and the OU commissioned the rabbis panel to discuss the issue of OU policy in shuls of how much or how little women should be involved in shul activities. And I took issue with one particular detail, which is not a small detail, and that is the halakhic possibility of a woman achieving the level of smicha. I pointed out that I completely subscribe to what our Rebbe, the Rav Zichron Livracha, made the distinction between the achievement and the ability to render a halakhic decision, and the other flip side is to assume a public communal position. That's a discussion in itself, which I did not challenge at all. The great Rabbanim, and who I have great reverence for, and of course it was based on the Rav, but the Rav said in its print did not have a problem at all with women achieving the level of knowledge and experience of rendering a halachic decision. And this rabbi's panel, let's just say, preferred that didn't happen, because that was just a small step in the direction of assuming a clergy position, which the OU took a stand against. And I brought not only in the source page the Rav's comments, but I quoted the Sefer HaChinuch in the prohibition of rendering a halachic psak while under intoxication, yayin v'shechar altesh. It's not only entering into the Mikdash area, but also the horot to render halachic psak. So Sefer HaChinuch said that this mitzvah is valid for men and for women, smart women who have achieved hora'ah. Nashim chachamot, yisha chachamah shegiya lehora'ah. You read anybody smicha on the wall, that's exactly what it says. Shehuigiya lehora'ah. That phrase means that you now have permission to render a halachic psak. And what the Rabbanim in America were trying to wiggle out, and they were saying that, look, they're two different piskei halacha. And it's something that, by the way, I heard from my own dear Rebbe Rav Shechter back in 1971, quoting the Rav. One type of halachic psak is nothing more than, it's called a mare makom. It's an address. You learned the Shulchan Aruch, the person asking the question never saw it, and therefore you happen to be familiar with the halacha. So there was never an issue that if a woman happens to know you know, what the bracha is on water, so that's not called a psak halacha, you know. What bracha do I make on water? So a woman says, shahakol nebevaroi. That's not called a psak. That means you're ignorant, she's knowledgeable, she tells you what it is. And 99% of the shilas, by the way, are in that category, because people don't know whatever. I'm not saying they don't know what bracha to make, but whatever it is, the cases aren't terribly complex, and usually there's so much precedent already that's called what Rav Shechter used to call a mare mokum, just to tell you where it is, and we're informing you. A psak of an innovative nature, where there are many complex parts to it, and you have to be fully knowledgeable and appreciative of so many different sources, sometimes conflicting sources, and then be aware of the reality of the person asking the question and the background and this and that. Sometimes that can be very, very complex, and you need somebody who's more trained and more gifted and more experienced and so on. And there's nothing wrong with a great shul rabbi going and bringing the question up to a higher authority. It was done in Europe with great rabbanim of cities who would ask other rabbanim, and there's nothing to be embarrassed about, and it's something fine. On this score, they had difficulty seeing the woman as being the one who's going to render that kind of a psak. And it's to that kind of a psak that the Sefer HaChinuch says a woman can achieve. And it's to that kind of psak that the Rav believed the woman can achieve. But they don't want to go along with it. But I think, and I restate that, I think here in Eretz Yisrael, I think we're a little bit ahead. We've moved ahead already in this area. And you can't turn the clock back. That's all. That's
Which category do you're
so that's right. That was a sticky point because I have great respect for Rabbanit Henkin and her program at Nishmat for Yoetzet Halacha in the areas of Tarat Mishpacha, where fundamentally the women are being trained to render a halachic psak, except they didn't call it that, and the term Yoetzet is almost a cosmetic type of. Naming so that they don't get into trouble. So and the RCA basically said, of course, it's a wonderful thing, and they recognize it. But they also said that there were some members of the Rabbanim there who are not happy with that either. But at least the majority of them were happy with it, because they see from experience that it is important. But they predicated. They said, of course, she has to be subservient to the psak of the Rav of the community, you know, and it's not really that she's rendering the psak. I can tell you, my brother's case in Teaneck, he has a yoetzet. Last year he told me the yoetzet got 1,200 chilas independently. Women would not turn to him because these are hypersensitive questions. They preferred speaking to a woman. And you know, the yoetzet didn't turn then to my brother and say, okay, what do I tell them? You know, I think it should be this and this. The woman had authority to say what she thought was correct, unless it was a crackerjack shayla that she had to ask. But that's fair game in any type of shayla. So that's become a little bit more acceptable. More acceptable. And they're just worried. They're worried that this may get out of hand. You have to realize in the 1950s, the big issue was the height of the mechitza. Those of you who recall the fight of modern Orthodoxy, of Orthodoxy in general, with the conservative reform, any poysik in town from Rav Moshe Feinstein, they were writing about the height of mechitza. Today it's a mood issue. Nobody writes about the height of mechitza anymore. Either shul has mechitza. What was that? Jerry, what was that? Erevin came a little later. Yes. Erevin was the next order of business, right? Came a little later, but in the 50s was the mechitza, and then the erev. So now it's women's issues, and it's a healthy thing that you know they give thought to it and so on. I think the fact that they recognize that we're an orphaned generation, that there's this need for a type of conglomerate of rabbanim to come up with some type of response. Because one name alone is not going to carry it. There's no longer a Rav Aaron Kotler, no longer a Rav Moshe Feinstein, and there's no longer the Rav, and there's no longer a Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. As we all know, that it's an orphaned generation. So second best is just to try to get some type of consensus. And the problem is when you get consensus, you're looking for the lowest common denominator, so all should agree, so all you need is somebody to be machmir, and then the level goes down in terms of the progress being made. That's where we are today. The Gemara says, Yiftach b'doro kishmuel b'doro. So the judge, the Shofet Yiftach, in his generation, was to be treated like Shmuel, who was the great Shofet. Okay, all that means is that Yiftach had authority. But it's not a compliment to the generation at all. You have to realize that. Yiftach b'doro kishmuel b'doro is actually a very, very stinging accusation about what the generation was all about. And here we are. You know, like we try our best, at least with the precedents that we did have. And even with the precedents that we did have, times change. So, you know, the fact that the Rav said what he said 30 years ago may not necessarily be what he would have said today. And that's a big question. That's a big problem. Because who is the person going to get up and say, I think the Rav would have said this today? Yes. You can't do that. It's very difficult. It's very difficult. But one thing is that we do know is that the Rav did shift opinions. This we know in his own lifetime. He shifted due to certain factors and so on. And he was able to justify it. But it's one thing is clear. The Rav was probably most responsible for the fact that Talmud Torah for women has been so upgraded, and he gave the push for it, the active push. It wasn't just sitting on the sidelines and saying it was okay, but he did it. You know, he gave shurim to women, and he felt that women should pursue. So and here we are. And the call to turn the clock back and stop teaching girls Gemara because look at the problems that we've encountered is that's not going to happen. That is not going to happen. Yeah.
I think it all depends how you define progress.
Mm-hmm. We saw that the Orthodox Union belonged to the Synagogue Council of America at one time, and then they went out of that.
That was an issue.
Consider that progress.
That was an issue in the 50s. The Rav took a stand against all of the Gedolim. Mamashi was a bold stand. Synagogue Council of America is an umbrella organization of all the Orthodox Reform Conservative. The problem is most of the Orthodox never joined it, but the RCA, Rabbinical Council of America, the OU did join it because the Rav felt that in issues of Klal Yisrael, it would be good for the American Jewish community to speak with one voice. But with regard to internal issues, he says, we have nothing to discuss with the Reform and the Conservative. He says, we're not going to sit and discuss with the Conservative and the Reform about the Nusach of Tfilas Musaf. You know, that's not on the agenda. But if there would be a civil rights issue, if there would be an issue of a global concern that the Jewish people, an anti-Semitism issue, I mean, you have that right now in the United States, you know, there's an anti-Semitism issue, big time anti-Semitism issue. It would be helpful, the Rav felt, that the Jewish community should speak with one voice. And he felt pragmatically that was the right thing to do.
Dr. Belkin wrote the seminal paper on that.
Okay.
Does that also apply to joining up with other religions?
Religions that the Rav wrote against. The Rav wrote already in 1964, confrontation, not to join the Ecumenical Council because he snuffed a little bit of some missionary activity there. You're going to sit down, we're going to start discussing Tefillah and Mashiach.
Talking about anti-Semitism.
Heschel believed that, Avraham Heschel, he believed that would be a good idea. The Rav thought it was not a good idea. But, so I say again, you used this example of Synagogue Council of America. Again, it's an example of the Rav was bold, and he felt it could work, but he was ostracized, literally ostracized by everyone, by all the Gedolim of the day, and he paid a price. You know, the Rav paid a price for many, many things. If you saw the film 10 years ago on the Rav, Rabbi J.J. Schechter said that the Rav was principled. Today it sounds strange that a person has principles, you know. But he had principles and acted upon those principles, and he paid a price. I mean, you know, the two great Averis, you know, as I say, that he went to the university and he became a Zionist, his family never forgave him. The family, the Briskis here in Yerushalayim, they never forgave him for it. I mean, but he did it because he felt it was the right thing to do. That's all. I don't want to open up a whole Pandora's box. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Rabbi Cardoza's treatment of the Rav just a week ago. It was a little, let's just say, different take on the Rav. But I have high regard for Rabbi Cardoza. But again, this is somebody who never really met the Rav, never studied for the Rav, read a lot about the Rav, no doubt. He felt that the Rav could have, given his standing in the modern Orthodox world, be more innovative in solving some of the Aguna issues. He said the Rav basically shriveled back to what he called a traditionalist conservative, not conservative movement, you know, conservative traditionalist halachist, and stayed there. He was still back in Brisk, and he was a magashir and so on. I didn't think it was correct with Rabbi Cardoza thought that the teaching of the Rav and Shir was no different than what he heard in Gateshead or in the Mir Yeshiva. That is really not true. The Rav was just light years, towering above, beyond any other Magid Shir that lived in the last generation. But okay, that's the problem with great people. Do you think that didn't happen with the Rambam? It happened with all great people, Rav Kook, different takes on great people. And then you can start figuring out, so what did Rav Kook say about this, and what did he say about that? And there was something you can go into YouTube now and see the Rav talking in 1969 about his understanding of Rav Kook, and he says, I don't think Rav Kook was a philosopher, and even if he was, there's no way to make any system out of it. You know, people have been working for the last two generations doing that, trying to systematize Rav Kook, but the Rav said that he never met a religious personality like Rav Kook. He says the man inspired, just who he was just a human being of inspiration of Yiddishkeit. And he explained why he felt that, which with examples. So fine, so Rav had his take on Rav Kook, and that's the way we are. You know, we have different understandings, different people. Okay, so we'll close the parasha on that. And today, we're looking at Parshat Mishpatim. And Parshat Mishpatim is one of the three parashiyot in the Torah that really garbles up most of the mitzvot of the Torah. And they are Mishpatim, Kiddushim, and Ki Teitze. You just take out those three parashas, you're not left with many mitzvahs. It's amazing, really, and everything is jam-packed into these three parashim. So one of them is a is something that we enjoy, and that's eating, right? A guy once asked Jackie Mason to explain to him what a Jewish holiday is. He said, well, it's all the same thing. They try to kill us, they didn't succeed, let's sit down and eat. Right? Every chag's the same thing. Let's sit down and eat. So where does the Torah speak about the prohibition of meat, milk, basar v'chalav in the context of the chagim? In the context of the yamim tovim, both in Parshat Mishpatim, and then again repeated in Parshat Ki Tisa, in the end of Sefer Shmot, where it talks about all of the Shalosh Regalim, and then as a tail end, it says, Reshit Bikurei Ad Matcha Tavi Beit Hashem Elokecha, says the mitzvah bring Bikurim, which we know the season begins on Shavuot, and in the same Pasuk, in the same breath, Lo Tavash El Gedi B'Chalev Yimod. Right, look at the source number one and source number two. You're going to think, it's not a quote, they're two Pasukim, the same Pasuk. It appears twice in Shmot Kav Gimel, Parshat Mishpatim, and Shmot Lamed Dalet, which is Parshat Kitisa. Reshit Bikurei Ad Matcha Tavi Beit Hashem Elokecha, Lo Tavash El Gedi B'Chalev Yimod. And they end the same thing. The Torah, for a variety of reasons, repeats the Parshat HaChagim in Sefer Shmot. So you have two readings of Lo Tevashel Gedi B'Chalev Imo. There's a third reading of it, and that's in Dvarim Parshat Re'ei, Dvarim Yudalit. And there, the subject is Kashrus. The subject is Kosher Beat. What you have in Parshat Re'ei is almost a restatement of Parshat Shmini, those animals which are the Behemot Tahorot, the Behemot Tmeot, the kosher animals, the kosher fish or non-kosher fish, the birds, the fowl, and so on. That's and there, in that context, it says in source number 3, Lo Toklu Kol Nevela, if the animal just dies, it wasn't slaughtered properly, there was no Shechita, it died from natural causes, so you're not allowed to eat it, Lo Toklu Kol Nevela. What you're allowed to do with it, Lagera Shebet Bisharecha Titinena V'Achala, doesn't mean a convert. Convert is Jewish. It means a ger toshav. So what is a ger toshav? Ger toshav is the status of a Gentile living in Eretz Yisrael who has accepted upon himself or herself that this is a Jewish country with a Jewish monarchy, and to observe all of the seven mitzvot of Bnei Noach. So that person is entitled to Olam Haba, that person is entitled to protection, that person is entitled that the government should see to it that he has provisions and life sustenance and so on. But he's a goy living in the context of Eretz Yisrael. So that's a Ben Noach or Ger Toshav. So to that person, you're allowed to give it. He's not obliged to, you know, shech the animal, to slaughter the animal. So if the animal is still fresh and you can still make some, you know, money off it, so it's perfectly permissible, like Gerashet Tetenda V'Achala, or Machorlu Nachri, you can sell it, which means you're allowed to gain profit from these non-kosher animals. Kiam Kadosh Atal Hashem Olkecha, you are holy. Lo Tevashel Gedi B'Chalev Imo. Now here, Basar V'Cholof, this gets thrown in into the context of Kashrus, which makes sense. I mean, it belongs in the kitchen, no? And that's where it is. The real question is, in Sefer Shmot, in today's Parashat Mishpatim, in Parashat Ki Tisa, why is it in the context of the Chagim? So many of the Parshanim say it's because in the Chagim, that's when people ate meat. Let me remind you something. The Torah gives us the mitzvah of Shechita at the end of 40 years in the Midbar. Moshe Rabbeinu gives it over to Klal Yisrael, and he says, and when you're going to be far from the Beit Mikdash, ki yirchak lecha makom, and you want to eat meat, B'chol avat nafshecha, that's called in the language of Chazal, basar ta'ava, meat because of lust. Maybe lust is a heavy word, but because you're hungry for meat. So do it this way. V'zavachta, v'kocha, tzoncha, kasher tzivitichah, the way I command you to do it, and so on. Which means that in the midbar, in the desert for 40 years, nobody just slaughtered animals. If you wanted to eat meat, it had to be a korban. It had to be offered as a sacrifice at the Mishkan, and those korbanot, like korban shlamim, let's say, so that you, the owner of the korban, received some of the animal parts for eating, that's fair game. So then you could have meat. But you couldn't just slaughter animals. There wasn't what we call chulin, something that wasn't part of the world of the Migdash. So there, Yamim Tovim, clearly you're obliged to come to Beit HaMikdash Ali Al Regel and offer korbanot, korban shlamim, korban simcha, korban ri'iyah Ali Al Regel. So there's a lot of meat going on. So that's why the Parshanim say here was a good place to remind us, keep the milk out of the equation. This is in order to explain the parshanut, the why is lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo, what's it doing in the context of the Yamim Tovim? That's the way most explain it. It's interesting that if we just jump to, I think I brought it somewhere towards the end. Let's see where did I bring it. Source number 7 in the second page. Take a look at the source number 7. There is a tradition of Torah Shebal Peh. That if the Torah says the same pasuk 3 times, it means it's coming to add something. The Torah is not just going to repeat the same pasuk second time, third time around. So each time it comes to teach us something else. So the first time it comes to teach us that you're not allowed to cook meat and milk, even if you don't eat it. Just the very cooking of meat and milk is a biblical violation. Second violation is you're not allowed to eat the cooked product of meat and milk. I'm stressing, the cooked product of meat and milk. Because the eating of meat and milk, if you have a pastrami sandwich and you eat an ice cream with it together, that's not a biblical violation because they're not cooked together. So how do I know that the violation of eating basar b'chalav is a cooked product? Because even the second time it says lo tevashel. The word bishul, cooking, is there throughout. So Chachamim said, separate the meat and the milk. That's a gzerah, that's a rabbinic ordinance. That's to keep us from falling into the trap of eating a cooked product of basar b'chalav. So that's why we don't eat. But not only from a biblical point of view do we not eat basar bichalav with a bet, meat in milk, but we don't eat basar vichalav with a vav, meat and milk. We also don't eat together, and that is a rabbinic violation. And then the Gemara talks about the separation of time between meat and milk. So how many views are there of the time factor of between meat and milk?
Many of
you
are Jews.
Oh, yeah, pretty. Who said that? That's pretty good. Many of you are Jews. Okay, so I taught Chulin and Beersheba. I did a chart on the board. At least I came up with 9 different shitas, 9 different views. Right? So the most extreme view, but let's keep it to ourselves, because if this gets back to Har Nof, we're in trouble. The most extreme view is 24-hour waiting. It's a Gemara. The Gemara says, Me'et la'et. Meat late means from time to time. If you ate fleishiks at 2 p.m., then don't eat milchiks till tomorrow, 2 p.m. That's an extreme view. That's an extreme view that, believe me, never made it in the world of halakha. But it's a view that's mentioned in the Gemara. Yeah.
And it's hegyoni because actually, if you want to go by digestion, the variables in humans could take up to 24 hours for that to clear your system.
Okay, so there, that's the factor. Maybe they knew it then, maybe they didn't. But I had something else in mind. Bishul means cooking. Cooking in halacha expresses itself in Shabbat, you're not allowed to cook, and in basar b'chalav, you're not allowed to cook meat and milk. Well, for that matter, you're not allowed to cook other non-kosher things with kosher things, which would constitute a cooking. What's the temperature of the cooking that constitutes bishul, let's say for Shabbat purposes? How hot does it have to be for you to have violated bishul? Does it have to be boiling?
Yad soledet
means you put your finger in, you pull it out fast because you're going to burn. So what's the temperature? Certainly it's much less than 100 degrees Celsius. Much less than the boiling point. So what is yad soledet? So like everything else, it's a little bit of a machloket, you know, because everybody's finger is different and everybody's, you know, boiling point is a little different. But it in Celsius, it runs between 40 and 50 degrees Celsius. So Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach took the median and he said 45 degrees Celsius. So 45 degrees Celsius is, and 100 degrees Celsius is boiling. So 45 degrees is more than lukewarm, certainly more than lukewarm. It's already hot, but you're not going to be scalded. You're not going to have to run to the emergency room and start putting on all kinds of cream. You stick your finger in, you pull it out. That's all. But there is a view that says 50 and a view that says 40 degrees. Now, a view that says 40 degrees is a big chumrah, because a lot of people can keep their fingers in hot water that's only 40 degrees. It may not be very comfortable, but they're not going to like pull it out right away. But then there are going to be some hypersensitive people who might pull it out at 40 degrees. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was looking for the medium, you know, where most people would pull their finger out at 45 degrees, and that was the degrees that he said. But it could be 40 lechumra. That's a stricter interpretation. Okay, having said that, you ate meat. You ate meat, and all right, it's now in the stomach and linings and so on. What's body temperature? Body temperature is 36 and a half, 37 degrees, right? That's what it is. You know, some people get fever. Get fever, you get 40 degrees fever, right? That we used to call 104, remember? 104. 104 is 40 degrees fever. People get 40 degrees fever, okay? And that's when the Acomo companies start making their money. So the question is, maybe if you then had milk afterwards, you're cooking up basa v'chalav in your stomach at 40 degrees. That's a possibility. It's way out. And the idea that within 24 hours, there still might be some residue meat in the stomach lining, that if you then introduce milk products and your stomach lining is 40 degrees, according to the sheet of the... It's a chumrah. I mean, my gosh, to wait 24 hours. And it's a... So, okay, so let's just relax, because that never made it to the world of halacha. So what made it to the world of halacha was...
Yeah. Is what happens in your body considered cooking?
You see, when you start working with the world chumrah, anything goes.
By putting it in natural eating.
Yeah, see, if you eat on Yom Kippur through intravenous, you have not broken your fast.
Right, so what happens in your body, is that considered cooking?
Well, it's probably not, but nevertheless, it's something that may have been a concern. May have been a concern. Okay, fine. You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised.
But doesn't that happen if you have a glass of milk and then you have a deli sandwich? Doesn't the same cooking happen?
Right, so here we're talking about the other way around. Right. Right, because we know that after milk, then this business of waiting is a lot less. And the truth is that the most lenient view, The Gemara says, "Bein suda l'suda," between meal and meal. So, what's between meal and meal? That is a very subjective call.
Bench.
What?
Bench.
So, who says that? Benching. Who says that? Rabbeinu Tam. So, there is a view that says, all you have to do is say Birkat Hamazon. You formally ended meal one, and now you can go on to meal two. That's a view. And as my grandfather Olav Shalom used to say, "Unerot oich, you can't learn it." And Rabbeinu Tam also knew how to learn a little bit, right? So that's a view. And there's another view that even takes a little... What you have to do is wash out your mouth. What some of us do actually after milchiks, after meal, wash out your mouth, and you go right to the other gender. So there's such a view too. And that was the view in Ashkenaz, by the way, until the 13th century. In the 13th century, they became machmirim. They became machmirim. They upgraded it to waiting 1 hour. From fleshiks to milchiks. They upgraded it, and from milchiks to fleishiks. Two ways. The chumrah was two ways. They upgraded waiting between milk and meat and milk. They upgraded it to 1 hour. What do you mean 13th century? What happened in the 13th century? What happened in the 13th century was the Zohar was discovered. I don't want to get into the whole question now, who wrote the Zohar, because then I'm going to get more emails from America, you know? But I can't wait till I'm on the billboards in Geula in Cheirim, because they've arrived. In Hebrew, that's called Yachas. That means they're looking at you. They're looking at you. Okay. So the Zohar in Parshat Mishpatim says that we should wait an hour between meat and milk, and milk and meat. So let's just take the meat. Let's just take right now the milk to the meat. None of us wait 1 hour, right? Anybody wait an hour between milk and meat? Nobody waits 1 hour, but some people wait 31 minutes. My house, that's what it was. We grew up that we waited 31 minutes. Most people just wash their mouth out and they can already eat fleishiks.
So what's on the kids with the pizza.
1 second. Hold on for the pizza. Hold. 1 second. So from milk to meat, most of us hold the shita, the original view, which was just wash out the mouth. Some took the 1 hour, but watered it down a little bit. We say 31 minutes. You know what that means? The majority of the hour. That's what it means. 31 minutes is the majority of the hour. But what about the other side? From meat to milk. So meat to milk, 1 hour, became dominant in Ashkenaz for 300-400 years. From the 13th to the 16th century. Mentioned in the Ramah. Ramosha Islas. 16th century. Krakow says we wait 1 hour. But he says he's recommending to upgrade to 6 hours. Now, where did he get to six? The Rambam. The Svaradim were keeping six all along. The Riv, Rabbi Yitzchak Fassi, they were keeping six all along. So the Ramah in Krakow is now recommending to upgrade. Now, you know, just because the Ramah said so, it doesn't mean tomorrow everybody starts waiting. The Ramah's granddaughter, marries the Shach, Reb Shabtai Cohen, who's the main Pesach on Yerodea on the side. I happen to be a Shtickle descendant from the Shach. And he says that waiting 6 hours, anybody who has Reach Torah, I love that phrase, Torah fragrance, if you smell from Torah, if you have Torah fragrance, you should upgrade, you know, to 6 hours. So you see that there's a push, and it's 2-3 generations. There's a campaign out there in Poland to upgrade to 6 hours, and it eventually makes it in Eastern Europe, Poland, Hungary, Russia, and that 6 hours starts moving west. And what happens? In Germany, they're still keeping 1 hour. And west of Germany, France, they're keeping 1 hour. But when the six hits the one, this encroachment, there's what we call in modern Hebrew slang, kasach. Kasach means boom, right? Or I call it the tornado effect. Or as Rav Professor Daniel Sperver writes in his book Minhagei Yisrael, Itzuv Minhag, the development of a minhag as a result of compromise. As a result of compromise. And what happened was, when the six clashed with the one, and the dust settled, so in Hamburg they waited 4 hours, and in Frankfurt they waited 3 hours, and then there was survival of the fittest, which means the three overcame the four, and that became the German-Jewish minhag. The German-Jewish, we call the Yekesha minhag of 3 hours, is nothing but a compromise of the one and the six, which then spreads to England because a lot of German Jews migrated there and so on. The tornado never hit Amsterdam. Never made it. So they're still sitting on the 1 hour. When I taught Midrashat Moriah in the 90s, young ladies coming from Chul, so a girl told me, I don't care who I marry as long as he's Dutch. Right. As long as he's Dutch, give the 1 hour. And you should know that the 1 hour is still with us on some halachic level. The Orach HaShulchan, Rabbi Yechiel Mechel Alevi Epstein, the Rav of Novardik, late 19th century, writes that if we're talking about somebody who has gastronomical issues or children, you know, sometimes people, you don't have to go Meshiga on the 6 hours. Because the 1 hour is still a view. It's still a view. And he says that there, you know, if you feel you have to be makel, you have to be lenient. For those who have gastronomical issues, that let's say an ulcer, a person has a stomach ulcer, and the doctor says you should have milk. So sometimes you feel it coming on, so I have to wait another 3.5 hours, you know. Don't burn your kushkas out because of that. Or Choshul says that you can do this. And I say this a lot of times to young, frum mothers. You got this four-year-old here, seeing everybody else eating ice cream. Now's not the time to be mechanech your kid. He's got to wait another 5 hours to have the ice cream, you know. You have to use a little seichel also. It's a... There's an allowance for the 1 hour shita, the view, you know, if necessary. So, and even with the 6 hours, it comes in three parts. Some have six full 6 hours, some have 5 and 31 minutes, which is the majority, and some have 5:01 into the sixth hour. So whatever you do, whatever your grandparents did, gesunte hate, it's a view. You know, it's okay. Because That's how this whole, you know, business started. But midoraita, it's the cooked product of meat and milk. And not only cooked product of meat and milk, we'll see in a few minutes, the meat had to be kosher and the milk has to come from a kosher source in order to have basar v'chalav. If the meat is non-kosher, then it's just a question of non-kosher. That's all. It's strafe. But it's not basar v'chalav. What's the difference? The difference is regular non-kosher, you're allowed to derive benefit. It means you can sell it, you can give it as a gift, and so on. Or you can market it, you can whatever. But if it's basar v'chalav, there's isa hano. You're not allowed to have any benefit. So it's very important to know what classification the avera is. Is it an avera of basar v'chalav, or is it an avera of machalot asurim, you know, general prohibited foods? That can impact, by the way, are you allowed to have stock in McDonald's? So McDonald's, you know, feature product is a cheeseburger. But you can assume the meat is treif. Because how can you sell a hamburger for 69 cents if it's kosher meat, right? You know, you won't be able to do that. You won't be able to do that, right? So therefore, the basar v'chalav in McDonald's and Chutz La'aretz is not basar v'chalav. It's treif, but it's not basar v'chalav. Unfortunately, I say with great embarrassment, there was basar v'chalav here in Yerushalayim when the McDonald's was running here on Rehov Shammai, because they were advertising the meat comes from Zlobleblek and the cheese comes from Tnuva. And they were making a cheeseburger and on a kosher of Pesach bun, you know, like I remember that Tzadikei Olam, you know, Tzadikei Olam, right? Right, for Pesach. What? It's opened up many years ago. They closed already. They didn't make it. They didn't make it. But I remember those ads, you know, for Pesach. Kosher, the Pesach. With badats, you know, everything was wonderful. But only Jews. That's right. So if you look at source number seven, the Sefer Achinuch, where he gives the rationale for the mitzvah, so he says that because we don't have another example where in prohibited foods, where it's also prohibited to cook the something. You don't have an isur to cook pork. No isur. You cook pork. Don't eat it, that's all. So he says, therefore, what is the crux of the prohibition of basar v'chalav? It's the combining. What does cooking do? Cooking creates new molecules, causes a chemical reaction of two things that are separate to now merge together. So that's the prohibition. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, and if you remember from Bereshit, Chol Eitz Pri Liminehu, every fruit has its, you know, specific species, and you're going to come along now and make a new species. And this author of Sefer Chinuch says it's the same problem of kilayim, of inbreeding different plants. Inbreeding plants or inbreeding with vines. HaKadosh Baruch Hu made this type of a vegetation. Keep it like that. Guard the created world of God and don't stop making new things. So he says the problem of basar v'chalav is essentially a problem of kilayim, of the merging of the two. And his proof is, you see that the crux of the issue is the bishul. Because even the eating of basar v'chalav, it's a cooked product. And even the deriving of benefit from basar v'chalav, it's only of a cooked product. So therefore, it's the cooked product. It's the cooked product. The cooking is the crux of the isur. So that's how he understands it. But then if you look towards the end of source number 7, I'm going to start from where four lines in the bottom, where it says, Masha'en kein b'sha'ar kol ha'sirai ma'chalot, all the other prohibited foods, there's no iser, no prohibition of cooking. V'chol zeh moreh, and all this teaches us, she'yesod ta'amo, the fundamental idea of the reason for basar v'chalav, hu mechamat ha'tarovet, it's the mixture of the meat and the milk. That's where the issue is. U'kinyan sh'amru b'kishuf. Kishuf is a type of sorcery where also the type of magical actions were done by combining certain elements, and he felt that that was really the crux of the iser. V'zeh ne'emar mitoch ha'dachak. He said, look, I'm saying what I'm saying, and I'm pushed to the corner, says the author of the Sefer Chinuch. I'm not 100% sure about this. He's being very honest. He says, my gut reaction tells me that the crux of basar v'chalav is the merger, the mixing of the two elements. Adayin tzrichim anu l'mudei ha'mekubal. We still, if we would have somebody who can bring me the absolute tradition from years ago, that would be helpful. So you see, he's groping a little bit in the darkness, but he's comfortable making his case anyway. And then he brings the Rambam. He says, "V'Rambam zechunol lebracha katav binyan tam acher." Rambam says something completely different. which is very different. He says, Amar, Kiyesh Ovdei Avodah Zarah Yavduha B'Maasei Tarovet Basaram Chalav. There was some cultic groups who used to do these things of taking the meat of a goat and cooking in its mother's milk. And this was the practice, this was the religious practice that they would do. And therefore what the Torah was coming along to tell us, it's just another of the so many prohibitions in the Torah to guard us from cultic activity, from Avodah Zarah. Plausible? We'll see in a second. But what does Sefer Chinuch say about this? He says, he's quoting the Rambam, "B'lachein hirchika Torah ota tarovet." That's why the Torah pushed us away from this combination of beaten milk, because certain goyim, certain groups, they would do these things. But then he has a comment, an editorial comment, "V'chol ze einenu shoveli." I don't buy it, he says. He says he'd rather stick with his case, that it's because of kelayim, it's tarovet, than to think that it's avodah zarah. Well, guess what? The Rambam was right. How do we know the Rambam was right? In the 19th century, this is pre-ISIS, before they destroyed the whole country of Syria and all ancient relics. So I'm sure you've heard of the Dura Europa Synagogue, that it was one of the oldest shuls in the Middle East, but there was this artistic work on it that actually is just not long after Churban Beit HaMikdash. And there's even an impression of the Beit HaMikdash carved out in the walls, and it's possible that the artist, you know, his grandfather remembered Beit HaMikdash. I mean, it's an unbelievable piece. But in that area, so a lot of stones were found. You know, the word chok, we call it chok as a law, but the word chok means engraving. So why is a law called a chok? Because if something was just written, so written means temporary. You can burn the paper, you can erase the paper, you can throw it in the garbage. But if it's engraved in stone, it's here to stay. So a chok means it's here to stay. Like the chukim in the Knesset, right? They're here to stay. Every Monday and Thursday, they're changed, right? The word chok means here to stay. It's engraved. Now, there was an ancient Semitic language called Ugaritic. I became acquainted with it somewhat back in my YU days. It was a very interesting phenomenon. I actually mentioned it last night in a shir. Our great Rebbe Rabban Lichtenstein, Zichron Levracha, before he came on Aliyah, was a great Rosh Hashiva and the head of the Kollel at YU. But he had a first cousin, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Lichtenstein, who also taught at the yeshiva. He taught Tanakh. It was a little bit of a look-alike, sounded alike. And I had this Rabbi Lichtenstein as well for Tanakh for four semesters. And we used a book by an author called Pritchard. It was called Ancient Near Eastern Texts to understand the Perek in Tanakh. So we had to go through all these, of course I did it in translation, but in the original, they were in Akkadian language and Ugaritic and what. These are Semitic languages. So on a stone that talked about a religious rite, R-I-T-E, ritual, for fertility of the land, they used to take a goat and cook the meat of the goat in its mother's milk. This is what they did. It's there. Now, it's obvious that Am Yisrael, the Kehan HaMitzrayim, they knew about this. I mean, this kind of rituals were known. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us, in the context of the Chagim, giving us the mitzvah of Bikurim, which is also associated with Shavuot until Sukkot, because the primary time framework of Bikurim is from Shavuot to Sukkot. Reishit Bikurei Admatcha Tavi Beit Hashem Elokecha. Yes, we also have a Thanksgiving ritual for the fertility of the land. You bring the Bikurim to the Beit HaMikdash. Lo Tevashel Gedi B'Chalei V'Imo. Don't do what they're doing. Don't do what they're doing. And here, we have an understanding of why, if you go back to sources 1 and 2, how can Lo Tevashel Gedi B'Chalei V'Imo be part of a pasuk that has to do with Bikurim? What does that have to do with it? It has nothing to do with it at all. But now we can understand that indeed it was a cultic activity that had to do with the fertility of the land. And the Torah comes along and says, do it my way, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Reishit Bikurei Admatcha Tavi Beit Hashem Elokecha. Don't do it their way. Lo Tevashel Gedi B'Chalei V'Imo. So the Rambam postulated that this could be. Sefer Chinuch just Behenef Yad rejects it, calls it an inner shoveli. But the Rambam was right. He was right on this. And the Ibn Ezra stumbled on the truth also, by the way. He also, the Ibn Ezra, he had a hunch that there was something here that had to do also with Avodah Zarah. So you have now an understanding of the connection of Bikurim and Lot Vashal Gedi.
Yeah, Baksha.
That's already a Masorah to Thrasha Baal Peh, where the Chalev Imo and to any milk, but the reason that the Torah does say Chalev Imo to teach us that it has to come from milk of a kosher source. That's why if it's cooked in Chalav of a camel, let's say, a non-kosher meal, so it's going to be treif, but it's not going to be a Basav Chalav. That's what it means by Chalev Imo. Also, Chalev Imo necessarily means a mammal, which led Rabbi Yosef Aglili to suggest that in the bird world of Ofot, there's no Chalev Aim. So according to Rabbi Yosef Aglili, it's like fish, it's parv. Chicken, turkey, duck is all parv. And the Gemara says, Bimkomosha Rabbi Yosef Aglili, Bishlu Besar of Bechalav. Lechatchila, because it was like fish. It was like fish. But Rabbi Akiva said that because the Basar of Rabbi Akiva agreed in principle that Chalev Eim means a mammal, and therefore Ofot are not part of this, but you know, it looks like meat. It has a little bit of texture like meat, and so on. And because you have to shecht it correct, and so on. It's treated like a fish, you don't have to shecht. But chickens and turkey, you do have to shecht. So it has fleshic tam. It has a little bit of fleshic flavoring here. So with the Rabbanan, Rabbi Akiva said, keep it off limits. Okay? There actually is a view, to be fair, that Besar Of is also Midoraita. So how do you know that? Although it says Bachalev Imo, because really what Chazal learned from the word Gedi, goat, it's not only goat, but it's any kosher animal. Because it says it again and again and again. It says once Gedi, twice Gedi, three times Gedi. And it comes to add all the kosher animals. How do we know that bird, Of, in the Torah is also called Basar? So remember the incident of the Slav? So what was the Slav? Slav was a bird. Clearly a bird, right? Rashi says, Min Ofu. And it says, quail, right?
Yeah, quail.
And it says, HaBasar Odenu Bein Shinehem, and the meat was still in their teeth, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu struck people down. So you see that the Torah calls the Slav Basar. And that phrase, Basar Odenu Bein Shinehem, is what causes the Rambam to suggest that to wait the 6 hours, because he didn't know from stymie dents. He didn't know from dental floss. And I'm serious about this.
He didn't know from dental floss.
Dental floss. And according to the Rambam, you must probably have meat particles stuck between your teeth that the digestive juices of the mouth did not break it down because they were caught between the teeth. And therefore, after 6 hours, it should be okay. After 6 hours, it should be okay. And he quotes the pasuk, HaBasar Odenu Ben Shinehem. So you see that there is a view, although it's not in the Mishnah, and I have to tell you, it's not in the Mishnah, but it's in the Mechilta. The Mechilta is the Medrash Halacha on Sefer Shmot. So you now have three different possibilities with regard to Basar Of. Either Basar Of with milk is Doraita, or Basar Of with milk is only the Rabbanan, or Basar Of with milk is 100% permissible. All three are possibilities. Yeah?
What about some people don't have fish?
Right. Okay, so fish and milk. Fish and milk. I'm glad you said that. Because Pesach Shabbat, we celebrated a bat mitzvah of my oldest granddaughter. So we are now moving to the club of the grandchildren becoming b'nei mitzvah. So it started with my b'chora, her daughter. Very nice. So we were in Shalabim. So in Shalabim, there was electronic luach, you know, and it flashes all kinds of different things. So they have halacha yomit. Of all things, it was basar b'chalav. And it says that that Svardim are careful. If you order pizza, you mentioned pizza. If you order pizza, you know, and you want toppings, right? Tosafot, right? So you can have tiras and batal and the shum and all the tosafot and tomatoes, whatever. And what? Anchovies or tuna as an extra. So it says on. I remember saying, no, don't take it with tuna. Then it says a small print, Ashkenazim mekilim. You know, Ashkenazim amekel. Ashkenazim amekel. But I know there's some pizza stores here in Yerushalayim that have heksher with the Beit Yosef. Beit Yosef is, once upon a time, Beit Yosef was a sefer of Rabbi Yosef Karo, but now it's Ashkocha on the wall, right? So that's Ravad Yosef's, the Shas Ashkochas. And it says that they don't give tuna as an option, as a tosefet, because of this shita. So it's brought down in the late poskim, and many poskim say it's a minak ta'ut, it's a mistake. That somehow the Gemara talks about as a sakana, as a danger, meat and fish, but not fish and milk. So there may have been a scribal error here with regard to fish and meat. I remember hearing from Rabbi Tandler when we studied biology. We were supposed to study biology, but we were doing everything that was on Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's desk the day before. So, and believe me, I enjoyed that much more than the biology. But so he told us that we do not know empirically what the sakana is, but if Chazal say it's misukan, I would try it. That's what he said. I wouldn't start up with them. So whatever it is, that's why we're careful about meat and fish. But milk and fish, most poskim say it's a non-starter and it's completely mutter. So Rav Avad Yosef, to his credit, writes that if you have a minhag in the family not to have fish and milk, minhag is a minhag, all right. But if you don't have the minhag, you're not obliged to start the minhag, even if you're a Sephardi. I mean, that was something. Right, don't start a minute. Let's sum a valchuva or a ger, you know, so it's pick and choose. So, you know, this is something you don't have to start. Yeah,
what's the taste? A cheeseburger being technically okay if the burger is made out of soy and the cheese is made out of soy.
So that's not a problem. It's all powerful.
It has nothing to do with the guy eating.
No, that's powerful. Look, anything that there might be a, what's called marit ayin, you know, it looks bad. So you always have to concern yourself with marit ayin. But if there's a big sign that everything's parv, and this has already been talked about in the Shulchan Aruch with regard to the juice from a coconut, which is called chalaf kokos. So what the Ramah says, you have to have the coconut on the table. I remember when we grew up in the 50s, some people grew up in the 40s, actually. But when we grew up in the 50s, margarine, you know, hit the... Today, nobody touches margarine, right? It's cholesterol on rye. But so you had to keep the margarine on the table because of marat ayin. Because of what the Ramah said about the chalav kokos. But then with time, more people using margarine than butter, so it became less of an issue of marat ayin. For example, today... They serve ice cream, you know. Everybody knows this thing called power of ice cream. What's the difference between milk ice cream and power of ice cream? Power of ice cream doesn't taste like anything. So that's how you know it's power of ice cream. If the power of ice cream is too good, I got news for you, it's milk. Right? Right. Right, so coffee rich also. Everybody knows today that they're power equivalents. You ever eat the power of a cheesecake? That's chemicals, right? Light a match to it; it'll blow up. It's chemicals. It's chemicals. Now, these things aren't too healthy. These parvazahin. The Rabban Shalom wanted you have milk. Okay, but all right. The issue that we have to discuss, and we're not going to do it now. We're going to do these pages yet next week. Is so? How many averas are there in the listing of 613? Is it one avera that you're not allowed to? A, cook meat and milk. B, eat the cooked product of meat and milk. C, not have the benefit of meat and milk. It's just one avera in the listing of the don'ts. Or maybe it's three averas. A, B, and C. We have three different avera. Maybe it's two out of three. We have to discover what's left out and why. As it turns out, the Rambam, in source number 4 and number 5, Sefer Mitzvot, right? It's 5 to 10. We finally got to the subject, right? So I'm in favor of lengthy introductions. Because I once heard a great shul rabbi say, beginning a drush on Shabbos, he said in Yiddish, before I talk, I'm going to say a few words. Then you know you are in big trouble. big trouble. Right? So source number four is Sefer Mitzvot L'Rambam Mitzvah Lo Taseh Kuf Pei Vav 186. And then this number five, Sefer Mitzvot L'Rambam Mitzvah Lo Taseh Kuf Pei Zayin 187. So the first one is Hiziranu Mivashel Basar B'Chalav. It's the prohibition of cooking meat and milk. And in source number five, Hiziranu Me'echol Basar B'Chalav, the eating of the cooked product of Basar B'Chalav. But there is no mentioning in Sefer Mitzvot of deriving benefit from basar b'chalav. So, I said there are three possibilities. There are those who count basar b'chalav as one lo taseh. There are those who count it as three. And the Rambam counts it as two. He uses two spaces in the listing of the 365 don'ts for basar b'chalav. But the prohibition of not having a benefit from the cooked product of basar b'chalav is, it's an isur, it's a biblical prohibition, but it's not there in the listing of 613. To this end, we're going to discuss next week, and it has to do with the title of the shir, Nekuda Nifla'a. What does Nekuda Nifla'a mean? A wonderful point. I remember when we learned Yeridei at the yeshiva, so the one who was giving the shir, Rav Yosef Weiss, Zichrono Livracha, he said this, the only time the Rambam uses this phrase. Okay, he was almost right. The Rambam uses it twice. He uses it in a different context too. But it's not that I'm a bigger gaon than Rav Yosef Weiss. I have a computer, and he never had it. So I just asked the computer, Nekuda Nifla'a, in Perish HaMishnah of the Rambam, and I got two different sources. So that was easy. You know, just have to know which buttons to push. But this, which will come out of the source number 6 on the bottom, you'll see it in the second page on top, underlined, Nekuda Nifla'a, the Rambam develops a wonderful point. You know what it means by wonderful point? A novel idea. A novel idea. A stroke of brilliance, basically. So he doesn't want to say, I really thought of something great. So he calls it a Nekuda Nifla'a. You have to really understand this point. And if you understand this point, you're going to understand clearly something not only about the connection of the prohibition of eating basar b'chalav and deriving benefit from basar b'chalav, but it's going to be very telling about many, many mitzvot, why certain biblical prohibitions are included or left out of the listing of 613. You know why that's important? Some of you know that I'm a little bit of a Zionist. Some of you, a little bit of a Zionist. Tziyani. Some of you know that. So I have to deal with our brethren in Chutz Laretz all the time. And I love it when they say, but the Rambam doesn't bring it in the Sefer Mitzvot. It's true. Does that mean he doesn't know it's a mitzvah? And give you dozens of cases where the Rambam believes that there is either a mitzvah or an avera on a biblical level, but it's not part of the Sefer Mitzvot. Why? Because of company policy. The Rambam develops policy, what belongs in the list, what does not belong in the list. But that does not impact on whether it is or not a Doaita at all. I'll give you a good example, you can take this home to sleep over. You know, everybody knows there's a mitzvah to remember Yetziat Mitzrayim twice a day, but at least once a day, right? If you didn't learn Masechet Brachot at the end of the first parak, but you remember it from the Leila Seder, and so on, Leman Tiskot Yom Tzedra Me'ez Ram Kol Yemecha Yecha Yemecha Yecha Hayamim Kol Yemecha Yecha Halelo. So all right, so there's a machloket about saying it at night. There's a machloket whether you have to say the third parsha of Shema at night because of Yetziat Mitzrayim. But with regard to saying the third parsha of Shema in the daytime, everybody agrees. Fine, so it's a mitzvah. It's a pasuk. Leman tizkor et yom tzedra be'etzrayim kol yimei chayecha. You turn over Sefer Mitzvot to every angle, you're not going to find it. So the Rambam thinks it's not a mitzvah. Of course, it's a mitzvah. Why isn't it there? So this has to do with policy. Why the Rambams included certain things and did not include certain things? If the Rambam spends a whole chapter in Hilchot Melachim telling us the virtues of Yishuv Haaretz, how come he didn't put it in the Sefer Mitzvot? Okay, that deserves an answer. But that's not an excuse for not coming in Aliyah. That's not an excuse. Are you not saying the third parasha of Shema in the morning because the Rambam didn't put it in Sefer Mitzvot? Are you not careful about deriving benefit from Basa V'Cholo because the Rambam didn't put it in? The Rambam didn't put it in. He has a reason. He's going to explain the Nekuda Niflah. A wonderful point here. That's why the share is important. To understand the Nekuda Niflah. Okay? So we're set for next week. Don't forget to come. Okay? Stay tuned. Right.
Yeah.